recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less and a friend of Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit download or store it on an iPod, iPad, any MP3 player, and then hit play. Today we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing, is here at ESI Bytes, is we're doing a show here that takes on a topic which even mainstream publications are covering, and we're bringing it to the legal community on a podcast. And today's topic is private clouds and data security, which is the subject of an article one of our panelists, Ben Kirschberg, published in Forbes. The economic value proposition of cloud computing is compelling, especially for organizations which are strapped for cash, like entrepreneurs, and frankly, like many law firms, which are oftentimes strapped for cash. But the cloud carries with it risks of protecting the security of data and ethical guidance from various state bars, and the ABA is starting to emerge. So given the sensitive nature of legal information, much of which is protected by attorney-client privilege or work product, that's the data law firms will be storing, the decision on whether to embrace the cloud isn't clear-cut all the time for lawyers. Since I like looking forward, I always enjoy doing shows where the legal concerns try to put the brakes on progress. This should be a very entertaining show because we've compiled a great group of diverse panelists. So let me briefly introduce our guests. First, we've got Katie Wood, who joined the Enterprise Strategy Group, or ESG, in 2011, covering information management, including e-discovery, enterprise search, content management, archiving, and records management. ESG is an internationally recognized IT analyst and business strategy group, which covers IT issues from within the IT ecosystem by working with vendors and consumers of technology. Prior to joining ESG, Katie covered e-discovery, enterprise search, information governance, and tax analytics as an analyst at the 451 Group. She also worked previously on the rollout of New York State's statewide access child welfare information system, a federally funded data warehousing and BI initiative. Katie holds a double master's in information systems and library science from Drexel University and a BA from Wellesley College, and has studied at NYU's Arthur Carter Institute of Journalism and Cultural Criticism and Reporting. Our second guest, Ben Kirschberg, founded the BK Advisory Group and is founder of Concero Group, LLC. He graduated from Yale Law School and the University of Virginia and clerked for Judge Gilbert Merritt of the U.S. Court of Appeals from the Sixth Circuit. After his judicial clerkship, which is in 98 and 99, Ben went to Silicon Valley at the height of the Internet boom and practiced law at the technology-focused law firm of Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati in Palo Alto. He then joined the a publicly traded NASDAQ company, WebMethods, where Ben worked on industry analysis and competitive intelligence, which gave him the opportunity to spend a majority of his time with software engineers and heighten his appreciation for technology at a macro level. Ben's a prolific writer covering the intersection of law and technology, and electronic discovery in particular. He's a regular contributor to Forbes. He also contributes to the Huffington Post, AmLaw's Corporate Counsel, Law Technology News, Texas Lawyer, Vistage, and Equine Journal. Steve, I'm going to kill your name. Dallancon?
Dallancon.
Dallancon. Oh, there's a silent C. Okay. Is responsible for product management and product marketing and for all aspects of e-discovery at an e-discovery vendor's K-Central's marketing communications area. Steve's a product management and marketing executive with more than 20 years of experience at top enterprise software and high technology companies, including running his own marketing consultancy in Silicon Valley. Prior to K-Central, Steve was vice president of product marketing at Kazion Systems, where he transformed the company into an e-discovery product and solutions leader before its acquisition by EMC. Steve was vice president of product management marketing at Go Remote Internet Communications, a NASDAQ publicly traded company that was acquired by iPass, and vice president of marketing for the Oracle Application Server Division, where he launched the Oracle Application Server and attained the top three market position while helping to double division revenue. Our last panelist, Stuart Hubbard, has 25 years of experience in the legal technology industry. He spent much of his career in software development, but he's also well known as a consultant, writer, and educator. He's the co-founder of Lawyers Advocate, Inc., a consultancy firm and continuing legal education provider based in Denver, Colorado, that advises private law firms, corporate legal departments, and the courts on all aspects of law office automation, management, and economics. He counts many of the AmLaw 100 among his clients, and he has provided expert testimony on e-discovery issues in both state and federal courts. Stuart was an undergraduate at the University of Delaware, and he completed an MA degree in all coursework toward a PhD in computational linguistics at the University of Kansas. He's also pursued additional graduate work in computer science at North Carolina State University and in business at the University of Colorado. Stuart has served on the board of the Denver Paralegal Institute and has been active in the law practice management section of the American Bar Association. He's also a member of the Litigation Advisory Board at Thomson Reuters, the EED Strategic Advisory Board at Merrill Corp., and the Advisory Board of Legal Electronic Document Institute, in addition to being active in working groups of the Sedona Conference. Stuart's widely published on topics relating to the application of technology to law practice, speaks nationally on these topics, and has published 3 books on the technology industry, including technology and law practice. He currently serves as firm-wide e-discovery manager for Schiff Hardin, LLP, a national law firm headquartered in Chicago, Illinois. So glad to have you all here, and let's jump into the topic. Ben, first I'd like to start talking about your article in Forbes called Data Security and the Imperative of Private Clouds. What first got you interested in writing this article?
Well, Carl, first, before I address your question, I'd just like to thank you very much for inviting me to join this panel today, which is a real honor. To understand how I got to the point where I wrote the article, there's a personal progression, which went from academic to strictly personal and then professional. Academically, I had read a great deal about the cloud, and particularly the cloud-first initiatives by Vivek Kundra when he was the first federal CIO. What happened next was much more personal. One of my law school friends and I founded a company, Concero Group, and decided to use Google Apps for Business. And when we did this, it was difficult for me not to notice that there was something very different. First, we didn't spend any money on servers. We had no IT support. And we were able to scale with no marginal cost as we added employees, which was very important for a quickly growing business, which in the last 24 months has grown to 30 employees. At that point, I really started to become professionally interested in the cloud, and it was impossible not to run into data security issues, especially with large and popular cloud service vendors being offered by the likes of Amazon, for example. Most recently, I actually had the pleasure of having a conversation with Steve, who began my real education as to the public and private cloud distinction from a security standpoint, and also educating me as to how few decision makers know about that distinction and what the ramifications are. From then, I decided to research it in greater depth and to write the article.
Yeah, you know, I think more entrepreneurs should go into law, because I had a virtual law firm for a couple of years, where I call my sabbatical years from e-discovery, and I had 25 solo practitioners networked on Basecamp, and we were practicing law for the general public, doing divorces and bankruptcies, and it worked, and I had no servers, and clients could access their case information. It was a dream until the credit crisis hit, and I decided to close it down. But you know, when you don't have a budget and you start these things off, the cloud really beckons you. That was my experience, so I share your experience too. So as a follow-up question, Ben, what's driving law firms and corporate legal departments to look at the cloud for accessing applications and storing data?
Well, I think there's an overall simple answer and then a more detailed answer. The simple answer for me is that law firms really cannot afford not to move into the cloud and to use the cloud and leverage it. Once you move past the early adopters, we now see a real shift in philosophy where law firms view cloud computing as the path to innovation and also to corporate growth or to law firm growth and working with their corporate clients. These strategies view business agility as being closely linked to cloud computing and working outside of their own firewall. The other thing I think is important to realize is that law firms are not individual actors. They're part of what I like to think of as ecosystems. And to a great extent, they don't have a choice when it comes to using the cloud and, for example, in e-discovery. And one way to think about this is to think of a Fortune 100 client that has 46 outside counsel, which is hardly unusual. and decides to use a particular e-discovery vendor. That client will dictate to its outside counsel, to all of them, which discovery vendor they will use. And law firms belong to numerous ecosystems. They have numerous large clients, and then they have cases where they can control who the e-discovery vendor is. But, you know, as I said, to a great extent, I think their hand is forced. In terms of – I'm sorry. Please, I'm going to stop there.
Okay. Well, Katie, from your independent perspective as an analyst, is the legal community embracing the cloud, or are we at a point in time where there's a lot of heated debate?
Well, I'm thanks for having me, first of all. And I'm on the enterprise side more than I'm on the legal side, but I would have to say from my perspective, both. They are embracing the cloud, but it's certainly not without controversy. If we're talking about using the cloud specifically for e-discovery, legal service providers have been doing business over the network for decades, so it's not something that's entirely new. As far as the legal community is concerned, there can be some technical inertia and risk aversion at play, I think, in adoption of cloud-free discovery, and not without reason. The cloud as we know it today has some risks involved, security being a big one. It's a little bit of a Wild West frontier, depending on who your provider is. But on the other hand, as Ben was saying, you know, they may not have choice, given that corporations, corporate litigants are wielding more influence in the kind of tools that they want to use. And adoption may ultimately be a cost-driven decision. If it's cheaper to outsource the IT infrastructure and maintenance, like you guys were saying in your practices, then that may be more of a driver, regardless of the risks there. Law firms already outsource some of their back office capabilities when they need to, and they're not primarily in the IT business, so this may be another one for them. I mean, a lot of people talk about cloud becoming a utility, like the electrical grid of the 21st century, so there's no reason for them to be, you know, to have their own electrical generator on site, and there may not be any reason for them to have their own data center. And in addition to that, with the rise of multi-sourcing and LPO, as things become more global with remote contractor bureaus, it just makes sense to use SaaS to collaborate that way. I will say I've seen much less adoption of public cloud technology for e-discovery due to the risks there, but that could change. Vendors are already starting to introduce it as an option. And if you look beyond e-discovery at other technologies law firms are using today for just day-to-day IT, they are already using the cloud for email, for archiving, backup or disaster recovery, document management, practice management, CRM. A lot of corporate data in general is already in the cloud with Office 365. You guys mentioned Google Docs, Salesforce, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So that's true at law firms and elsewhere, and I think that trend will only increase.
Steve, your company's embraced the cloud, and so from the perspective of a vendor, do you see this debate tilting in the direction signaling more acceptance of the cloud by law firms and in-house legal departments?
First, thanks for having me also today, Carl. My quick answer would be absolutely yes. I think that the economic advantages and the efficiencies of cloud computing are, shall we say, irresistible, and there are a myriad data points to back this up. In fact, a gentleman by the name of Barry Murphy of the eDiscovery Journal this morning published a new piece titled Cloud-Based Discovery Solutions Are Here to Stay.
I hate it when the eDiscovery Journal beats us to the story.
No.
I know Kevin Esposito real well. He's friends with Barry, but anyway, that's okay. We're going to go deeper than he went, so go ahead.
Excellent. So, Katie, of course, in ESG have a ton of data, but since Katie's on the call, I'm not going to preempt her research. But I think that, as has been quoted by other analysts, that one of the reasons e-discovery is now a pressing issue for a lot of companies is that ESI in its many forms dominates legal proceedings because modern business is mostly conducted using electronic communications and electronic records, and therefore a fundamental requirement for an organization seeking to evolve their e-discovery processes to a strategic business process is really the considered and appropriate use of technology and automation. In other words, technology is really contributing to the problem, but technology, therefore, is also part of the solution. So I think that there are definite legitimate signals, and as Katie pointed out, there are loads of applications and services that law firms and corporations and even individuals are using via the cloud today.
Well, Stuart, you actually work inside a legal organization, so and you touch many legal organizations and have. How do you see this debate on the cloud playing out right now from your perspective?
Well, the way it plays out is sort of ironic. Law firms are not thought to be, you know, great innovators with regards to the use of technology, the adoption of technology, the understanding of technology. But in the case of private cloud applications, at least, law firms have been using it for e-discovery purposes for a long time. And it's certainly nothing new. And in a sense, the debate doesn't exist about, you know, whether it's reasonable or not. But the debate always centers around, you know, which technology should we choose and how much does it cost and which is appropriate for a given matter. But law firms, and we're an example of this, are quite accustomed to having vendors host large data sets for us to then remote into to do our document reviews and from which we do our document productions. And there's really not much debate at all about whether that's appropriate or not. So I think it's one of the kind of unusual circumstances in which law firms actually have kind of pushed the industry. Another example would be document repositories, where you've got multiple parties who are jointly using a single database for evidence management or for research purposes, and all of the work product that's related to those individuals is collected and categorized and stored separately, and nobody really thinks much about it. It's pretty common practice these days.
Although, Stuart, I would suggest that since you are a software coder, when you're talking to law firms, they already appreciate what you bring. There's lots of concordance shops and summation shops that have created data silos over the years. But I mean, due to your skill set, I think you attract a lot of the entrepreneurial lawyers. So,
well, I hope that's the case. And I do know that, you know, in practice, we've been pretty successful in a sense, being vendor-centric, using the skills, talents, technologies that are available to us through the vendor community to good use on behalf of our clients' matters.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about electronic discovery. First of all, I'd like to ask Katie if she has a sense of how much insight do corporations have into what they're spending on e-discovery, and then as a follow-up, can the cloud enable better insights into overall spending control of what's a fractured panel process?
Sure. Well, ESG recently surveyed corporate counsel to find this out, and we tried to get the most serial litigants with the heavy litigation burden to see folks who were ahead of the maturity curve. And every one of them could tell me their budget for outside counsel, what they were paying to their law firm, but most of them, the lion's share of them, were not tracking e-discovery and didn't know how much they were paying for it off the top of their head. So for those who were, more than half of them were spending over $1 million a year on it. But e-discovery can be difficult to peg because it's been an outsourced process for so long. It may be billed from third parties through law firms. It may not be an itemized fee in your bill. The pricing structures themselves for services can vary quite a bit from provider to provider. It may not be apples to apples, or they may be covered through liability insurance. So there's often a lack of transparency in what's being delivered, what's charged, how the big number at the bottom of the bill got there. Other times it's just not tracked consistently from case to case. So in response to your follow-up question, well, first of all, I'd say that this is changing. There's more competition in legal services right now, more pricing pressure and cost sensitivity from clients. So it's creating kind of a reverse auction scenario from some providers bidding on engagements, and it can create a dangerous kind of race to zero for services. So I think clients are becoming more aware of the costs and even more competitive in asking for alternate fee arrangements or different arrangements than they have now. But I see it as dangerous because you really don't want to commoditize legal services by choosing a provider based solely on that, on cost, any more than you would want to, you know, go for the cheapest doctor or the cheapest plastic surgeon or the cheapest babysitter for your kids. You know, there's cost is not the only value there. So to get to your follow-up question about using cloud to gain insights into the process, I think there is a better way, and the better option rather than just, you know, having a race to zero on cost is to take a measure-it-manage-it approach. Litigation isn't a production line, certainly, but it's becoming more globalized, more multi-sourced among multiple parties, and you can monitor that and sort of streamline the process like a supply chain almost. And it's typically been harder to do that with outsourced services than it was to do internally, but with the cloud, you have the collaboration model to get some transparency there. You can capture key performance metrics, how productive the attorneys are being, how many documents they're getting through an hour, what is the, you know, the time to completion for the case, how far along are you? So you can measure and monitor that across firms and providers, across cases. and compare those. Some tools have dashboards you can use to access and get updates. It's a better way to get price accountability that I think consumers are looking for in the market based on efforts and results, rather than pitting the providers against each other based on price and running the risk of cut rate services down the line.
And I know we've got other panelists on here that might have a perspective on using the cloud to get better insights. So I'll throw it open. Anyone else want to add something on that? Or go ahead.
I was going to say this is Steve, and it's actually playing off a thought that Stuart gave me when he was talking about hosted document repositories in a single database. And that kind of talk from somebody who resides within a law firm, I think, is rare in my experience. And the notion of what we at Case Central would call a centralized legal repository, or what Stuart calls a single database, really offers a lot of measurability options to measure the types of things Katie just mentioned are not being measured. And from a process management perspective, it's difficult to improve that which you're not measuring, because you have no idea of where to begin and where to end. And the notion of using a single database or this centralized repository means that if you have multiple matters and multiple cases in one place, and you can measure all sorts of key performance indicators or KPIs, you can then determine where your process falls down and how to improve it. So that type of approach, I think, as we move forward into using the cloud and providing these centralized legal repositories, will help immensely.
Well, Ben, you distinguish in your article between private and public clouds. Why is this distinction important to lawyers? And why does cloud-based e-discovery offer more costs and risk reduction benefits?
Well, it's a distinction that's extremely important to lawyers. And what I'd like to do is speak first about the benefits, the cost benefits, and then move to the risk reduction benefits, because that's where I think the distinction is incredibly important. In terms of the benefits to lawyers, to go back to the point that Stuart made, and then to give two examples, I think the notion of having a central repository is extraordinarily important. And the first example I'd like to give is the example of repeat litigation. So if we think about a car manufacturer that is sued over and over for products liability, at some point it will become clear that the documents that are relevant are surfacing again and again. And by storing them in a central repository that can be accessed by different legal teams, both within a law firm or within a corporation, and then outside with one another, take advantage, for example, of previous privileged designations, which is extremely important and extremely time-consuming if it's not done correctly. The other thing I think is important and a benefit of the central repository is the ability to collaborate both with third parties such as outside counsel and often even with opposing counsel on a secure platform. And I have read about examples where when parties work with outside counsel, they actually share costs. So that's certainly a benefit, because these costs can get quite expensive. In terms of the risk reduction benefits, that's where I think the distinction between public and private clouds is incredibly important, because I've actually moved to the position where I think the risk reduction benefits only really apply and can only be realized when using the private clouds. So to back up for a second and provide the distinction, I'll just give two very quick definitions. I see a public cloud as one that's offered by very large vendors such as Amazon. Electronically stored information is also stored on the server with the ESI from other companies, which entails all sorts of risks, which I'll talk about. Whereas a private cloud, you have a server that's dedicated to one client and data is not commingled. If we look at the risks of the private cloud, the first one that comes to mind, which I think is incredibly important, is that you're never really sure where your data is stored. Amazon's website, for example, explicitly states that its servers are located around the world, but you don't know where. And when you lack that control and you're kept in the dark, things can be highly problematic. An example of that is where a host country, say a country in the EU or China, has laws regarding data transfer that don't match our own. And when litigation arises, that's a problem. The other example I'll give, which was in the article, is two corporations that share the same public cloud. And Corporation A, in this example, has electronic health records, and those are governed by HIPAA. Corporation B finds out that the federal government has subpoenaed all of the data that's on that server from Corporation B, and it essentially seizes the server. Well, Corporation A has a number of problems. First of all, they no longer have access to the data. And second, by having relinquished control to the data, they're in violation of HIPAA and have to inform their clients that they're in violation of HIPAA. And that's not a situation that a law firm wants to be in. So those two, I think, are incredibly important. The third is data destruction. And knowing that your vendor has policies in place where they will destroy your data if necessary. An example would be if you wanted to transfer your data to another vendor, or, for example, if the vendor were to go out of business. The key to all of these risks, I think, is to understand that it's extremely difficult to contract around them from a legal perspective. So e-discovery vendors, for example, need to be very proactive when it comes to protecting their rights and the rights of their clients. And that cloud vendors, but cloud vendors really don't make concessions in their service level agreements. And an example of that, which I talk about in the article, is Eli Lilly, a pharmaceutical giant, who only last year wanted to shift to Amazon some of the accountability and risks for network outages and security breaches to Amazon, as I said, and they weren't able to come to an agreement. And if Eli Lilly is not able to negotiate an appropriate service level agreement, or SLA, then most e-discovery vendors won't be able to either. And that makes the use of the public clouds highly problematic.
So, Katie, how does cloud-based e-discovery software deployment differ from an on-premises software?
Well, Steve might be more Steve might have a better idea of this than I do, since that's something that his company does. But I will kick it off, and Steve can shout me down if he sees me going down the wrong path. One reason customers go with SaaS, obviously, is to get out of the IT business. So with SaaS, someone else is running the software on their own infrastructure and hosting your data on their own system. So there's no internal deployment required, no infrastructure investment to run it, and no need to scale it for peak demand, which is a big issue in e-discovery, because it's unpredictable when cases are going to come up and you need to, you know, suddenly have terabytes more of capacity, or, you know. So there's no software updates, nothing like that. Other things like disaster recovery and backup may be provided by the provider. They may need to be examined in the SLA, as Ben was saying. It's still sort of a caveat emptor situation where those things are individually negotiated, or your provider may just have a boilerplate arrangement that you don't have any room to negotiate in. So in a private cloud, you have to make assurances that there are provisions for this. And in the public cloud, there may be no provisions for it. Another factor is there are no internal IT staff required to support it, which is key, because there can be training involved in working on these systems. And if IT aren't dedicated to the task, which they aren't at a lot of enterprise companies, for litigation response, it can be really disruptive to routine internal operations when litigation kicks in and they suddenly have to drop everything. So there still can be some manual elements when you're doing e-discovery in the cloud, because the data has to get in there. So you still have to get the data to the provider, and if the volume of the data or the network is such that you can't do that over the wire in an acceptable time frame, you may still be delivering it to where the provider is located. And plus, even with SaaS, there needs to be some way to process and load the data into the tool, which might be done by the provider behind the scenes, or sometimes it's done in collaboration with corporate IT and Lit support. And there may also be other services that are available behind the scenes in SaaS. Some service providers sometimes use SaaS like a portal with a menu of other services available, and that may be more manual on the back end, but, you know, at least your IT team doesn't have to be doing it. Now, because there's so little involvement on IT's part, SaaS is often purchased at the departmental or business user level. It might be purchased directly by the legal department because IT doesn't have much of a role. And that can be good and bad because it can be done without their blessing, but it also means that sometimes it happens in violation of other IT governance initiatives. So it can be a double-edged sword there.
I thought that was a very comprehensive answer. Steve, you got anything to add?
I agree. Katie sold herself short.
Cheers.
Well, one thing you talked about in there, Katie, that I was planning and I'm still planning on doing a separate show on as a follow-up to this, is one trend I've noticed is the deployment of more sophisticated e-discovery tools that are rolling out. You know, this predictive coding area is one of them. And it requires substantial IT skill to deploy, you know, virtual machines and upgrades to servers to even get the tools to work. And let's not forget about redundancy capability. And this becomes even more painfully clear. I'm aware from talking to some people that I know that are in-house, when you try to upgrade software to newer and more powerful versions. Can the cloud address these concerns? Are these valid concerns, Stuart?
They are valid concerns, and I can kind of address them, I think, from the perspective of a representative of a private law firm, with the kind of obvious notion that we're a law firm and not a technology company. Certainly we are a knowledge-based, services-based business, but we're not a technology business. We rely on technology. We want it to work for us, but we don't want to reinvent the wheel. And to the extent that we can rely on experts for providing that technology to us, I think we're better served than we are if we have to rely on our own internal resources, just because, again, we're not a technology person or a technology company. We do have a fairly significant IT department here at Schiff Hardin, and they are excellent at what they do. They keep the systems up and running. The network never seems to break. Everybody seems to always have access to their data and so on. But when you think about how many applications they have to support a law firm of this size and this diversity, and we're not even a big law firm by a lot of Chicago standards. We've got about 400 lawyers. There are literally hundreds of applications that are running on our network at any given time. I'm primarily focused, as this discussion suggests, on litigation support and e-discovery, and some of those applications are among the more complex of all the applications that run on the network. So it's difficult for us internally even to upgrade what are relatively, pedestrian litigation support tools. And we do have some of those tools in-house. But if we want to kind of adopt to and take advantage of, make use of the latest and greatest, the newest new thing in our business, we do have to rely on the vendors. So it could be a little bit because of my background, since I kind of come out of the vendor community, that our firm is very vendor-centric, and we want to choose the vendor that best matches up with technology to the matter that we have on hand. That being said, there is a different point of view out there, and some large law firms, very large law firms, have seen this as a business opportunity. They see, just because firms that have 400 or 500 lawyers, can't put the infrastructure together to support these applications and these upgrades and all of the backup and systems requirements needed to run them, doesn't mean that we can't. We've got 2,000 lawyers, say. So some law firms are seeing that as an opportunity to become kind of the go-to e-discovery counsel for their large, Fortune 100 clients. And then that client can still go to another outside counsel as sort of the merits counsel. So this, and I'm thinking of a couple of firms in particular. I don't know if it makes sense for me to name them, but.
Well, I'll name a one-word response to that and I know some people that talk about this and they think they're in great shape, but, things change annually depending on what tools you have. And my one-word answer would be Howery is an example. I mean, they pointed out in their discussion of their demise that they had gotten too invested into certain systems in e-discovery, and the vendors, basically outmaneuvered them. They weren't competitive.
Right. Again, they're not technology companies. And there have been actually some technology companies that have been spawned, as we know, from law firms. Law firms that have tried to do this. A 10X is the classic example.
Yep.
Came out of a law firm. A company that used to be called Catalyst also came out of a law firm environment. It was spun off because, again, they realized, we really don't understand this business well enough to be able to sustain it, nor do we want to invest in the infrastructure that it entails. So,
well, let's talk about some of the cloud-based security concerns, Ben. And you mentioned in your article the ABA's request for comments on issues concerning client confidentiality and lawyers' use of technology from September 20, 2010, which raise a good number of security issues the cloud raises. Would you care to touch on some of these?
Sure. I think if you could sum up in two words the ABA's advice, it would be proactive. And I think they're absolutely right. From a law firm's perspective, for example, when choosing an e-discovery vendor, the law firm will need to protect, first, its own interests, second, its client interests. And with respect to client interests, one of the security issues that the ABA touched upon is industry regulations regarding the handling of corporate data. And they give two examples. One is HIPAA, which I discussed earlier, with respect to healthcare records. And the other is FINRA, which advocates for investors with respect to regulatory issues. And I think it's very important for law firms and corporations to make sure that their e-discovery vendors, that their solutions provide what's necessary so that they're constantly in compliance with different federal regulations and state regulations. And as I gave before in the example, if a public cloud server is seized, then you can be in a lot of trouble. So next, I think you need to make sure that the vendor has in place robust security capabilities, that they have proper certifications like SAS 70. As Carl said, as you said earlier, redundancy is incredibly important. And two things that come to mind from a legal perspective, to touch upon the example earlier, I think a vendor needs to have an obligation to notify you in the event that there's a security breach. They need to have an obligation to notify you in the event that they're served process, which means that either your data could be in jeopardy or that you need to do something to address that, such as migrate to another server or another vendor, whatever the case may be. And, finally, as we've talked about a little bit today, we need to make sure that the vendor has proper destruction policies with respect to data. But I think the most important point that the ABA made is that this area is changing so quickly, both with respect to law and technology, that it's constantly a cat and mouse game. And they specifically advised attorneys to keep abreast of developments in this area. And I think if there's any advice that I would take away from what the ABA wrote, that would be it.
Before I ask my next question, I want to mention the help I got in preparing for this podcast. I probably did more reading for this one than I've done since I did one on 502D with Tom Allman and Judge Grimm. But the David Reese at Thorpe Reed & Armstrong here in Pittsburgh speaks a lot for the ABA on privacy concerns, and he gave me a whole bunch of presentations. And one of the areas that he pointed to is one of the state initiatives. Local bars are starting to come up with rules, and he pointed to North Carolina, which in April 2010 proposed an ethic opinion subscribing to software as a service while fulfilling the duties of confidentiality and preservation of client property, which put responsibility for the security of data when a cloud-based service is selected squarely at the feet of the law firm. Steve, I just want to ask you, should lawyers be concerned by ethical rules such as this one?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? I think it's first worth noting that at its meeting on July 14th of this year, the North Carolina Ethics Committee voted to send several proposed opinions to subcommittees for further study, including this FEO. And I would also note that from Case Central's perspective, this opinion seems to turn on the assumption that the law firm is the entity selecting the software as a service provider, which for many of our clients, I can't speak for other vendors, but for many of our clients is not true. And so in those cases, I'm not sure it would have as direct of an impact. However, I would say in general, I agree with the basic principle articulated in the opinion that a law firm may use software as a service if, and this is the big if the notion of reasonable care is taken to effectively minimize the risks to disclosure of confidential information and to the security of client information and client files. But where this particular FEO runs into some static is, I think has been publicized in a couple of responses or comments, one of which came from the Legal Cloud Computing Association this summer. And one of their responses, which I would agree with, is that the opinion as written would affect an incredibly broad range of vendors. And as Katie mentioned earlier, cloud-based software and services that law firms use include email, voicemail, text and SMS messaging, online backup and storage, and many others, which make compliance with it as it's written a practical impossibility. And then there was also the notion in the FEO as it was originally drafted that employees of the vendor's data center become agents of the law firm, and that's not likely to happen. And so there are some, I think the intent, or there was good intent behind it, but the specifics of that particular formal ethics opinion still need some work, which is why it was voted for further study.
It's hard to legislate these things, but I would say from experience, the lawyers always make the easiest target, and even if the corporations pick, there's always a risk. I mean, you look at things like the Zubelake opinion, where Judge Shindlin basically said, I need a neck to ring, you know, it's going to be the law firm that's responsible for making sure that collection is done the right way. Or you look at ABA opinions on like outsourcing personnel. And I've always found this interesting as someone that has had a long history in review. If you hire a contract attorney and they have conflicts or breach, you know, ethical obligation, that lawyer who hired them has some comfort because the duty is on the contract attorney. To, you know, step up and say, I have a problem, I just said something I shouldn't, or I'm doing something I shouldn't. But if you hire a paralegal, it falls on the shoes of the lawyer that hires the outsourced paralegal to watch out and take care for those things. So I'm just saying the lawyers make easy targets for being in charge of trying to make sure there aren't any problems. So Stuart, what do you think of the due diligence burdens that this puts on law firms to comply? Especially, you know, small 400 attorney firms like yours.
Yeah. It is a significant burden, and I think fundamentally what most courts would say, and maybe I misunderstood a little bit of what you were saying, Carl, but what most courts would say is that these duties are not delegable. If we're the, you know, outside counsel of record, and we're the ones that are purporting to the court that discovery is done properly, reasonably, and we think sufficiently given the proportions of the case, and our vendor screws up or our contractor attorney screws up, we're still liable. We're still on the hook. As I say, I just would kind of echo your thoughts, you know, that the lawyers are the easy target. But frankly, you know, we sort of view it as, yeah, we are the only target. And that's why there's this kind of three-legged stool that needs to be balanced in these complicated manners. There's general counsel. They have certain interests. A lot of times they just want to get this matter off their plate or do it for some small amount of money as possible. And to them, that's a good result. Then there's outside counsel who needs to follow the rules and needs to be a competent and diligent officer of the court. And then there's the vendor who's actually doing a lot of the technical work that needs to be overseen by, well, who? Who do they work for? Do they work for general counsel, whose matter it is? Or do they, and who, as Steve, I think you mentioned, you know, might actually have hired them? Or do they actually work for outside counsel, even though they may or may not have been hired by outside counsel, but they go to them for direction for the document review and so on? So I think it's one of these areas where, you know, lawyers have to be especially diligent. And I think that we're coming to the point, and I think a lot of courts have come out with opinions with language to this effect, that there's some minimum level of computer literacy that's required to practice law in certain jurisdictions and certain kinds of cases. You just need to be able to know how to go in and ask the right questions of your vendors and of your contractors to make sure that they're doing the job right. because you can't simply delegate it and say, oh, gosh, it was their responsibility, Your Honor. We told them what we needed to have done, and we expected them to do it right. The judge, as Judge Shinlin is the good example you just brought up, is still going to wring the neck of the lawyer that's standing in front of her.
Yeah, it makes people that do consulting like me happy, very happy. All these technical issues that lawyers need to understand. But...
Well, so, that's actually, you raise another point that's kind of implicit here. Yeah, I mean, some, as we know, you know, Judge Grimm would tell you that in many cases, you really should hire an expert, and you're, you know, if not committing malpractice, at least you're not being diligent if you don't, because it takes an expert to understand how to run keyword searches or how to do certain kinds of coding or how to oversee document review in a way that makes sense and is cost effective and so on. So it does create work for the consultant community, which sort of brings back again us to that question of proportionality, which is something I end up talking about quite a bit here. You know, how much do we spend? How much is reasonable given the value of the case?
Yeah.
So all those things kind of need to be thrown into the pot and mixed up. And,
well,
that's where legal judgment comes in.
Katie, we've talked about a lot of different types of issues here with cloud-based solutions. What advice would you recommend to law firms which are seeking to hire cloud-based solutions? Is there anything you can leave them with?
Well, I think we've kind of touched on this, especially Ben discussed some of the jurisdictional issues when you're looking at a provider and where your data is located. If you can figure that out, there may be cross-border issues in how they deal with privacy of you know, their workers. If it's a corporate litigant, maybe you're not even allowed to look at their data without their permission or process it. So there's that kind of thing, especially for countries outside of the U.S. Our Patriot Act is an issue for them, so getting a subpoena is an issue internationally, or having to deal with the feds coming in and wanting to see the data. They just have different notions of privacy and that kind of thing. I'm not really qualified to give legal advice on this, but there are some horizontal considerations for everyone. Obviously, you need a viable provider, and others have spoken to that. You need SAS 70 certification is a good idea, safe harbor if it's international, although I wouldn't say that's enough as a rubber stamp. You really need someone that you trust there. You need an airtight SLA, as Ben was saying, and that you've really gone over with a fine-tooth comb with provisions for disaster recovery, you know, act of God, data loss liability. Bankruptcy is a big one. If your provider does go out of business, potentially someone could be buying your data off at auction, you know, off of their hardware. So, yeah, you also need to know about availability, uptime, those kind of standard considerations. You need to know how long it might take to get your data back if you need it. Ben touched on deletion. It needs to be destroyed, and you need to know that. Otherwise, it might still be discoverable, and even if you don't have it, it's still your responsibility to get that. So some of these are kind of worst-case scenarios, but lawyers specialize in that, and, you know, they have happened to some people already. It's still a little bit of a Wild West territory. Law firms in particular, I'll just underscore the jurisdiction, I think, is a big issue. Where you're litigating, where the data is with your provider, and you need to understand the legal implications at play there.
You know, it's sort of interesting, and I didn't think of a question for this until I was just at board about to start, but, you know, maybe I'll throw this to you, Steve, one that just popped into my head. I was at a conference in New York, an e-discovery conference, and there was a panel of forensic experts who basically took shots at the cloud left and right, left and right, left and right. Be very scared of the cloud. It's going to destroy your ability to get evidence. It's going to destroy this. It's bad. And I just got back from a week's vacation in Bermuda, so I didn't feel like saying anything, so I didn't. But I will now. I just find it interesting when you talk about the use case and the business, you know, advantages that, you know, that sometimes business outweighs, you know, an evidence issue. You know, Steve, I mean, what's your sort of reaction to that type of a discussion?
Well, my visceral reaction is those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, because clearly there are legitimate concerns about data stored in the cloud, as there are legitimate concerns about people trying to hack into corporate networks and insider theft, which is at an all-time high, and all of these things. So there's
there's enough concern, there's ample concern to, I think, go around the table. And I would suggest that it depends on what the business issue or what the business driver at hand is, and you need to determine, you know, what the risk appetite is and what you can stomach and what your cost profile is, and then you use the best available tool to accomplish the job. The good news is that at no time in recent history have so many different tools been available, both in the cloud, on-premise, hybrid models, public cloud, private cloud, to do different things. And of course, we're talking about one particular use case here, which is e-discovery, but that would be my initial reaction to that sort of topic.
And I would just add one other thing that, and I was just looking for some balance. I tend to agree with you that those are valid concerns. But, you know, if evidence becomes harder at one level, you can always look to the handheld device. I mean, the way people communicate, the storage is, you know, it's just you got to move with it and try to figure out creatively how can you gather evidence. Just like we did when we started with e-discovery. Like, where's the paper? Oh my God.
Well, another way to balance that, another way to balance that too, is to look at the public cloud and what a fertile field that is for litigators to find out information about people and about enterprises.
Yep.
That's just freely available. You know, so, and you could argue in that sense that actually it makes the development and discovery of relevant evidentiary materials easier. It certainly gives you more options.
Absolutely.
Yep. So, well, last question, and this may not have much to do with the cloud, depending on your answer, but it's always great to hear possible topics for next shows. Since you each have a different IT perspective, I'd like to ask each of you, starting with Katie, then Ben, then Steve, and Stuart, what do you see as the most likely IT trends in the e-discovery space for 2012?
Well, I would say the broader legal sector trends for e-discovery I'm seeing are towards greater automation. There's more competition for legal services, more accountability in legal services. The customers are demanding and more outsourcing or multi-sourcing. So I'd say on the product side, we'll see more search and computer-assisted methods because it's becoming more, you know, outsourced among different parties. We need more efficiency, and there's more data that's coming all the time. So it's not like that's going to get any easier. And the flip side of that is there need to be more QC features to ensure the quality as we have more computer-assisted methods for statistical sampling and that kind of thing. Also, more project management, more supply chain style capturing of performance metrics like we were talking about to drive efficiency. And there's still got to be continued integration between products and e-discovery because it is technology's evolving and it's still kind of an immature space. So I would say in tandem with that, probably more price commoditization as some newer solutions arrive on the market. And looking at general IT, the trends are global mobile social, as we've been talking about. So that continues to make litigation response and e-discovery kind of a moving target as we get new data formats and locations in. And we mentioned earlier, technology consistently develops faster than the law or the regulations to police it. So it's always, as someone was saying, a cat and mouse game. But I think ultimately we're driving towards, in the enterprise side, better proactive information management to just call out some of the less relevant data that's clogging up the downstream document review. More competitive legal services in the future. But for now, the maturity of the e-discovery market is really kind of all over the map. And technology is really only one piece of that puzzle, obviously. So some companies are going to get there before others. The price sensitivity we're seeing now may accelerate it. There may be more guidance from the bench or the committee for the FRCP, which could change things quite a bit for corporate litigants and IT, but I think that's the upshot.
Okay. That's a lot in there. Ben, you got anything to add?
A little bit, I think. It was great. Thank you. Both of my answers relate directly to e-discovery. The first is that I think the current pricing model, which is based on price per gigabyte in e-discovery that is used by almost all e-discovery vendors, will erode, or at least begin to erode, for a number of reasons. Katie spoke earlier about commoditization, and when you have price elasticity, it forces prices down, which leaves vendors competing in this sort of market based primarily on price. So it's basically a race to the bottom. Second, given the fact that all of this is happening in the cloud, which is scalable at almost no marginal cost, the price for additional gigabytes is so low that vendors really can't afford to try to profit from it. Or if they do, I think savvy customers should refuse to pay for it. And Katie said something earlier, and I think Steve might have something to add to this as well. Cost is not the only way to measure value, and I think that's extremely important, and I think that will begin to bear itself out more and more. My second point is that relates to the public cloud, and experience, as they say, breeds familiarity. And I think in this case, experience will breed discontent, or rather, familiarity will breed discontent. And I think as e-discovery vendors start to really move towards the public cloud and market themselves that way, and then they find that they can't negotiate an appropriate service level agreement, I think you'll have the Eli Lilly situation happening again and again, except in this market, because they will have marketed themselves to potential clients, they'll essentially have to backtrack on their promises, and that will lead to a lot of disappointed customers.
Steve?
Yeah, I think I have three things, although they, I think, dive a little deeper into a couple of things Katie and Ben already said. The first of which, to follow on to what Ben was saying, is that pricing model to me, which is really an outcropping of value, the pricing model for e-discovery must move away from the notion of volume equals value. And that's Ben's notion of per gigabyte pricing. It has to move away from that because that's just unsustainable, even though that's been the way that most service bureaus and e-discovery vendors have been charging for decades. And that value needs to move towards the value of combined software and services that drive better results and more transparency and ultimately better outcomes. So that's one. The second, and I think Katie mentioned this as well, is that mobile and social media are becoming certainly, and Stuart said this, he didn't use the word concern, but I will, more of a concern as corporate information gets increasingly dispersed. And there's this weird phenomenon we first saw with email where people are willing to say things in email that they probably wouldn't say to your face. And that's been extended, by the power of two on social media. And there's a wealth of information out there that probably shouldn't be out there. And at least for our lifetimes, it's not going away. And then the third is that the cloud will necessarily continue to evolve, and that will be an interesting evolution.
Okay. It's really painful to be last, Stuart.
Last.
You got anything to add?
Last but not least. I could make maybe a couple of generalizations based upon what we've just heard. I think the trend towards outsourcing is going to continue. I think we've kind of established that. I think it's going to take two forms. I think it's going to be outsourced from our perspective as outside counsel towards vendors and also towards our clients. More and more of our clients want to do more and more of the e-discovery work in-house. And as the technology gets better and as the enterprise solutions become better and easier to deploy, I think our clients will continue to do that. As that technology develops, and in concert with that, as we develop these performance metrics that we've been talking about, I think e-discovery will be a business that will be much better understood in terms of what its value really is. And I agree with everybody who said at this point that value can't be based just on quantity. It has to be based on something else. And the notion there that we really want to get to, and I think technology is driving us there, is to align the financial interests of outside counsel with their clients so that our efficiencies as applied to a matter are just as beneficial to us as they are to our clients. And oftentimes that comes through in these attempts that we've been making for many years now to come up with flat fee arrangements for certain kinds of matters. I frequently, as a kind of a thought experiment, gone to vendors and say, can you just give me a flat fee for this case? Here's what the case is about. This is how much it's worth. This is how much data is in it. Can you just quote me a number and say you'll do all the discovery work for that number? And if they can do that, it seems like law firms at some point should be able to do that with their clients. They should be able to go and understand their business well enough and say, okay, Mr. Client, we know this kind of a matter. We've done it many times before. We'll do it for X dollars. So that everybody is set up so that if the matter is closed sooner, done more efficiently, if that's the better result, then kind of everybody wins. And I think technology is definitely pushing us that way. I think I'm optimistic, given that I'm kind of a technologist at heart anyway. But certainly the market is maturing.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Katie, Stuart, Steve, and Ben for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.